Do narcissists know they're hurting those that love them? Do they even care? Why is it so easy for them to break societal rules? Welcome to this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy. I have over 20 years of counseling experience and am a narcissistic abuse survivor myself. Today, we're going to talk about the makeup of a narcissist in this podcast episode. Thank you so much for being a listener. Please leave a review. It goes a long ways in helping this podcast. And subscribe so that you're notified of upcoming episodes. Are you finding these podcasts helpful? Consider giving a small donation, the amount of a cup of coffee. All contributions are greatly appreciated. So let's listen in on this episode of a TikTok live replay. Someone today, at some point, or maybe even on the television, but some point today, you're going to be gaslit. I guarantee it. At some point, something, someone, or somewhere is going to make you doubt yourself, question reality, and wonder if you remember or got it right. Gaslighting is way more pervasive than we think, and it has been one of the reasons that we don't see it more often and we don't recognize it is because it has been packaged, repackaged into doing something in the benefit of us, for the good of us. They know better. You didn't understand that right. You don't know all the facts. You're going to hear something that's going to repackage what you know to be true and sold to you again in a different form. And it's going to be sold as in your benefit because you're not bright enough, know enough, don't know all the angles, aren't smart enough. Something, you're going to be not enough in something, or maybe you need to be taken care of, or it's just too hard for you to understand. But in some way, something today is going to repackage information and gaslight you about it. I've been working on a online course on cognitive dissonance. I don't know if you've heard of cognitive dissonance. I talk about it a lot. When you're gaslit, that moment that you hear something, let me give you for instance, you tell something that's happened painfully in your life, and this person says to you, oh, I don't think it's that bad. Maybe you're misunderstood. In that moment, you feel like this feeling, this uncomfortableness. And at that juncture, that pain, that angst, it makes you question what you understood, how you interpret it, and that makes you wonder if maybe you did get it wrong. So it creates this kind of this haze, this confusion, the momentary confusion. And then it also creates this desire to correct, this push, to push back, to fix it, to set it right. All of that uncomfortableness, that is what is described. The word is cognitive dissonance. The feeling you're having is stress from the miss, the gap between what you know to be real and what you're being told is real. What you know to be actual truthful versus something that actually you have a completely different view of it and you know more information, or it actually happened to you and you're describing your life. This is called cognitive dissonance, and it creates a pain, a stress, and I don't want to really call it anxiousness because it's not so much anxiety, but it creates this uncomfortableness that actually is described as agonizing, especially when it becomes long-term. And that's the hard part about gaslighting, is that how many times a day do you think this actually happens? That you get information presented to you that's been redesigned, that it has been sanitized or it's angled in a particular way in order for whatever agenda, some ulterior agenda. How many of you guys have been watching Starz show Gaslit about Martha Mitchell? She was the wife of John Mitchell, who was the attorney general for Richard Nixon's administration. And he was instrumental in the tapping of the DNC. And they got caught and she knew about it. She knew something was up. And then she attempted to do a whistleblowing. And they actually held her hostage in California, because she was very well liked and had a pretty large social platform. So in order to contain her, they held her hostage. Her own husband held her hostage in order so that she couldn't speak up. They've actually called it the Martha Mitchell effect. So when you've been not believed, when those around you have actually dismissed what you said as too much, too crazy, just not, it's out of the realm of possible. You're experiencing what's called the Martha Mitchell effect, especially when you go in and you tell a mental health professional or your doctor or somebody else who should listen and want to believe you, and then they end up not believing you. So Ramble on Rose is wanting to know how to explain to my siblings to stop talking to my ex who's an abusive person. This is a common problem, and there's a couple reasons why it's happening. So let me give you some context to why this may be happening. I am starting to mention it. I have it. I've referred to it once, but I'm going to put up a video this weekend about something called the mask of sanity. The mask of sanity. What happens is that people who are very toxic, people who are a high end of narcissistic or sociopathic, are very good parrots. They have learned to mimic those around them. Think of Ted Bundy. I don't know how many of you, I'm now dating myself, I know that. But Ted Bundy, by the way, worked on a suicide hotline. He actually knew personally Ann Rule, who wrote a book about him. So if you want to read a great true crime story about what happened, check out Ann Rule's story about, I'm trying to think, it's like The Stranger Beside Me or something like that. She and him worked together, and she knew him. He also had a major in psychology, and he got married, believe it or not, and his wife was clueless of what he was up to. So how is that possible? How could somebody who is that dark, who is, very sadistic person, very, very pathological, predatory person, pull off having all these people be unaware of that part of themselves? Well, they're very good at imitating your emotions. So they've learned how to look like you, talk about the things that you're talking about, and even to have facial features that are similar to you, so you think that what's going on in the interior of their head is a similar thing that's going on in your head. Yes, exactly. It's called The Stranger Beside Me. Thank you so much. Written by Ann Rule. So when we see that, so that's one problem, is that they look like us, act like this. They're very good at this. Because think about it. If your survival depended on your ability to mimic those around you in order for you to do what you want to do, you'd get good at it, right? I mean, I'm talking survival. Like you're going to go away forever for the rest of your life, or you're going to be ostracized and kicked out. You're going to get very good at that, because especially if you're having a high IQ on top of it. So that's one problem, is they're very good at mimicry. The other thing is that they use charm. Now, we often use the word charm as if it's a nice thing. It's a good thing. Oh, he's so charming. Or isn't she so sweet? That's how we kind of talk about it in terms of women. Oh, they're so sweet. Charm is actually a manipulation. It's a positive social interaction that actually is requesting and building with you an alliance. They're using flattery and niceness in order to disarm you and to build rapid rapport and trust. What you feel around these people is this incredible envelope of charm. They're very magnetic. They know how to use power over people very well. So you got this mimicry going on. So they look like you and they're charming on top of it. So you want to like them. You feel this pull to want to like them. So back to this question that she was asking about, how do you get family members to stop talking to your toxic ex? Well, they've bought into the narrative. This person's presenting a powerful version of something, and they've been believing it and thinking that it's real. And as a result, they think that what's happened then is they think that you're exaggerating, that it really isn't that bad. And I know, I bet you, I had just a friend tell me this story herself. This is happening to her. I bet you've even told your family some of the bad stuff that's happened inside this relationship. You know, shocking stuff, like mouth-dropping stuff. And they were shocked. But some part of them couldn't believe it enough, because the mask of sanity is lulling them into a denial, like a false. They're being gaslit. Honestly, this is, again, I started out today talking about gaslighting. Gaslighting doesn't just happen in words. It can happen in the way we present things, or the way we present ourselves. They're actually being lulled into believing a false perception. So what do you do about it? I think your recourse here is to let them know that it's extremely hurtful to you, that it actually for you is if they're picking sides and making an alliance, and that it really is an invalidation and a minimization of what you've gone through. Now, what do they most likely do? Because I kind of already can anticipate this. I bet you can too. Because how many of us have been here and this has happened to us? I suspect they're going to minimize you for saying that and telling you that he's not that bad and they don't really want to pick sides. I think that's what you're going to hear. But you can let them know that when they're doing this, they are picking sides. You're not asking them to pick sides. They've already are picking sides, and you're asking them to stop picking sides. You're asking them to remember the relationship you have with them. I don't think this is going to go very well or go very far unless they are more mature people, emotionally mature people. But that's what I guess what I'm saying to you is that as you see what happens, it tells you a lot about how healthy or not healthy these individuals are. And if they're not able to hear that, self-reflect, understand what they're doing to you, then maybe it is what it is and you're going to have to be okay with not having a close relationship with these families. Are you in a narcissistically abusive relationship and struggling to leave? Maybe you feel like you're in an impossible situation. I know I sure felt that way for a long time. I struggled to get out. I was so paralyzed. Then this is an event you're not going to want to miss. It's a live webinar on August 18th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Dr. Kristen Milstead. She's the author of Why Can't I Just Leave? A Guide to Waking Up and Walking Out of Pathological Love Relationships. During this interview, we're going to talk about things like how does a trauma bond start? How do we break it? What is cognitive dissonance and why does it cause such problems? Why do we find it so difficult to leave? This is going to be an incredible evening that you don't want to miss. Be sure to get your tickets in the show notes in the link below. Why don't narcissists own up to their mistakes? There are several reasons, and it's not just one thing. There's several reasons to why they don't own up to their mistakes. One is that they don't have a conscience. Their moral compass is extremely dull, if non-existent. Yeah, they may know the rules, and they don't like the rules because they don't want to get caught, but the rules don't impact them personally in a sense of they feel bad when they break a rule. Have you guys heard of Kohlberg's moral development? Stages of moral development. There was a researcher years ago who actually developed several different stages of moral development over time, how we move from, oh, I don't want to get caught and hurt, to all the way to we have this ethical understanding of the complexity of things. What I found fascinating, and I don't remember every stage, I will actually look it up now that I'm thinking of it, because it's really interesting, and it applies to narcissists and narcissistic abuse. But essentially, when children are first very, very young, they just learn that they get caught. There's consequences they don't want. They don't want to, you know, you touch a hot stove, you're going to get burned. They don't want to get burned. So they stop doing things in order not to get caught. That's why they do what they do and say what they say. It's just because it's all about management of risk to self. But as we start to grow up and we get more sophisticated and we understand how we fit into the greater community, into the world, the global community, we develop different kind of ethics. But I'd be fascinated to see how many of you think we get very far, how much the average person in the world, how developed their moral compass is. Not a whole lot, I hate to tell you, not a whole lot. But narcissistic and sociopath people are operating at the very bottom, if at all. They're just not. They don't want to go away to prison forever, and they certainly don't want someone to kill them for what they do, but they don't have any angst about how it makes you feel. And they're not terribly worried about the big consequences, like the ripple effect of everyone else. Let me give you an example. So I got into a relationship, wrote about it, called Love You More, and it was a con, guys. He knew I was a widow, that I had had an inheritance, and it was a legacy from my late husband. He knew that, and he was after it. So if you want to read what happens, it's kind of written like a true crime story. It's called Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex, Addiction, and Double Cross. And I, at near the end of the marriage, said to him, listen, this was what's left by my deceased husband, and it's a legacy for me and my sons. He frankly didn't really frankly give a fuck. It really wasn't his problem. In fact, this is what he said to me. He actually said this to me. Well, divorce has never been fair to me. Why should it be fair to you? This guy did nothing to earn any of that, and he didn't make the kind of sacrifices that I made, and it frankly wasn't his money. It wasn't his. So that's kind of a piece of how it looks, this utter lack of concern for the bigger picture for you. It's called The Love You More, The Harrowing Tale of Lies, Sex Addiction, and Double Cross, and it's written by me, Carrie Kerr McAvoy. So you have somebody who doesn't really care. So when you ask them to apologize, they don't really see what they did wrong. You have to see the big picture of, oh, that I shouldn't have done that. That's one reason why they say, I'm sorry you feel that way. They're not sorry they did it. They just sorry it's creating drama for you. So the other thing that happens in this is that not only do they not have this moral compass, but they also are, they can't accept responsibility. They don't have a great depth of self-reflection and capacity to be reflective and introspective. You're asking them to sit back, take a look at themselves, see how this might have consequences, and take some ownership over it. And they don't do that. So as a result of that, then they don't have any bad feelings for what happened. They're just bothered that there's inconvenience for it. So no, they don't feel guilt, and they don't feel, because guilt is sort of a form of remorse. What they do feel, if you could dig back deep into the core of them, there is a lot of shame. But this shame is at a very deep level, a very unconscious level that's actually pre-verbal, because the errors that went wrong in their psychological development happened way back when they were tiny, before they really had a good grasp of language. So they don't have words for this angst, this uncomfortable feeling that they have that something's kind of inherently wrong. That's why they don't apologize. They aren't sorry. To them, this is one thing I've kind of explained before, that to them, the world is really at war, and there is no one that is on their side. You know, when you're trying to prevent someone from knowing you, to find out that you're actually not all that, because really, okay, let's be super, super vulnerable for a moment. We're all human, guys. We're all imperfect. We all make mistakes. That's what both makes us not all that, but it also makes us all that. And it is when we start to become more psychologically sophisticated that we realize that our humanity, our brokenness, the parts that are complex and imperfect is what makes us so lovely. But see, they don't know that. They just see that and think, oh, that's shitty. That's a piece of shit. No one's going to ever know that about me. Again, I'm putting words to something. There are no words. They don't have words for this. This happens so when they're so little. Try to imagine an 18-month-old you're trying to explain this concept to. You can't. This is an 18-month-old just knows they feel bad. Mommy looked at me wrong, or daddy walked away. They just feel bad. They don't have words for it. So that's what it feels like in their core. They feel bad. That's why there's no self-reflection. That's why there's no introspection. And here's the thing. These things are, yes, they could be worked and grown and gotten better, but it's very hard to cultivate the skill when it's just not really there. That's why these are considered pervasive conditions. Pervasive. Pervasiveness in the DSM-5 is only used for two conditions: developmental delays, like intellectual delays and autism, and personality disorders. Do you think you could change an autistic person? By the way, I'm autistic. Do you think I can correct that about myself? No. By the way, I like it about myself, but could I correct it? No. Do you think somebody who ends up having an IQ that's super high or super low can correct that? No, they can't. They can learn to work around it, get new skills and augment it to utilize it better, but they can't correct it. Personality disorders are in that same category. That's why we warn you, please, please don't get your hopes up. Please, this is a pervasive condition. This is an enduring condition about these people. We need to be careful. We need to be very careful. Do you do direct treatment work with narcissistic personality disorder? Yes, I have. I have done direct treatment work. I was very, very fortunate. I got my degree in the late 80s, and at that time, well, even now, we don't do a whole lot. When we go through what's called a psychopathology class, which is a class that talks about all things go wrong with our psychology, our mentality, our personality, most of those classes go through fast, because we have to know the whole DSM-5. We have to know how to diagnose and do what's called differential diagnosis. What's different between anxiety and OCD, and how does that differ from delirium and addiction, and on and on and on. We have to be able to do all of that very, very well, because we are licensed to diagnose. We are one of the professionals who can do this, along with psychiatrists and doctors, psychologists are licensed to diagnose. So we have to be able to do that. So in those classes, they're doing a fast cover over a massive topic. And as a result, we don't really slow down and unpack personality disorders, except the program I went to actually had several authors. They like to get faculty members that were writing about theoretical stuff. And so I had a class on personality disorders specifically, borderline personality and narcissistic personality disorders specifically. So yes, I was very well trained in this area, and I find it fascinating. And one of the areas I actually ended up in my practice seeing a lot of, I ended up seeing a lot of, believe it or not, we say narcissists never get into therapy. Narcissists do get into therapy, just not the way we think or for the reasons we think. Yes, and I've spent years with them. I've actually worked with several for more than a year long. One of them I think I saw for 7 to 10 years I worked with this person. So I do have an experience with this and know a lot about it. But it also, I know from it personally. I ended up growing up in a family where there's personality disorders as well. And I ended up being in a relationship with a narcissistic abusive person. And you end up thinking, well, how could you as a psychologist get into a relationship like that? How could you, why did you miss it? Well, because they're very good at mimicking us. And when we meet them, we think that we have met ourselves, which is what love bombing is. That incredible over the top, wow, I think I met my soulmate. This person gets me. I've never met anyone like that. Well, the reason is because you meet yourself. And how could that not be a pretty intoxicating experience? So also at the time I was grieving, I had just been widowed. My whole life exploded, so I was very vulnerable. They look for that too, by the way. I want you to be warned. They're looking for vulnerable people. They're looking for a juncture in your life when you're not in your best game, so that you can't you're more susceptible. You're easy prey. By the way, anybody who's trying to do brainwashing, cults, all that, they're always looking for someone who's in a vulnerable spot. Think about who gets pulled into those relationships. There's a really great author, and I always feel a need to say this because I've already sensed it. Well, somebody asked me a question of, did I have a prenup? We start to like do this to each other. We get what happens, I think, I'm going to try to get into your head when you hear me say these things, is you want to not have this happen to you. It scares you to hear that it could happen to someone who's a professional who'd been working all these years in the field and still missed it, and even had experience with narcissists in practice and still missed it. It gets scary. One of the things that Don Hennessy says in his book, How He Gets Into Her Head, the name of the book again is How He Gets Into Her Head, is that we have met a person who has honed a skill. Think of sharks. They get very, very good, because this is how they're living and surviving, is preying off other people. They prey off all the, you know, the life, the biology in the ocean. So because they're doing that, they get super good at it. And Don Hennessy, after 30 years of working in the Irish law enforcement, said that if you meet a really good one, you're not going to be able to resist them. And if you've not gotten into one of these relationships, thank your lucky stars, it means you have not crossed paths. We cannot sit back on our laurels and think that we're better than that, that we have better boundaries than that, that we are strong people and would never be susceptible to that. No, he actually said, and I'm quoting him, you just not have met a sophisticated enough predator. You've just been really lucky. Good for you. I'm happy for you. So really watch the tone we have with you. I know that person didn't mean anything. By the way, I did check into a prenup. This is more complicated. You have to read my book to understand the ins and outs of it. I don't really want to get into all of that, why it happened, how it happened. But let me tell you, there is very extenuating circumstances that made it a highly complex issue. Do narcissists ever wonder if they're narcissistic? I do think that they sometimes ask themselves, are they? But I don't think it has the same meaning. And I don't think they see it as a fault. I think that let me kind of step back for a second. When you have a very unique worldview and you feel very confident of it, and you know why you are the way that you are, and it makes sense to you in your worldview, would you want to change that if it's kept you safe thus far and you actually are enjoying how it's working for you? It doesn't bother you that you're hurting other people because you don't have a conscience, so that doesn't affect you. And you're getting the thrill of doing this, and you actually like hurting people and making them suffer. By the way, that's another feature of this. We don't talk about that a whole lot, is that they enjoy your pain, they enjoy your suffering, especially the more pathological they are, the more they have more sadistic qualities. So why would I want to be different than that if that's the way I am? I would embrace that. My ex, he would say, sometimes ask me, because he knew I was a psychologist and really enjoyed that, and he would say to me, so do you think I'm a narcissist? And then he would laugh at his own question. He would think it was funny. He didn't really care. To him, it was a bragging point. And I would sometimes even say to him, I don't know if you saw the movie, The World According to Garp. And I would say, yeah, The World According to You. And he'd laugh, goes, yep, that's the way it is. So there was actually, for him, a bragging right. It really wasn't something he felt uncomfortable, ashamed of. Because you have to feel remorse. You have to feel a sense of responsibility and a guilt and accountability. And they don't. The fact that there's a part of the brain that actually shows activity when you're in pain over what you've done. They've looked at the brains of those of us who are not narcissistic versus the brains of those of who've been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. They're different. They're different. It doesn't light up the same. Are we surprised there's a lack of activity in that brain area where they don't feel any remorse? There's no pain, so it doesn't really bother them. So why should they change? So they may wonder, but it really doesn't, it doesn't really affect them. They're not invested in that. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. We will be back next Thursday, since Monday is a holiday in the United States. But I can't wait to see you next Thursday. In the meantime, be sure to get your tickets for the live webinar on cognitive dissonance with Dr. Kristen Milstead. Believe it or not, we're already coming into July. You don't want to miss this event. It's going to be amazing. And until next Thursday, I'll see you then. Bye-bye.